That was Sam Davis with In Your Company. Now you've got Sir and Miss with their fortnightly session of science they never told you about at school.
Welcome to another science show on Cambridge 105. In today's programme, we hear how medicines are being developed here in Cambridge. We talk to a chemistry expert working in the industry, and we think you'll be intrigued by techniques that take some of the guesswork out of making pills.
Plus, as the university term comes to an end, we have a roundup of some local events you might get to. All that and more after this little bit of a tune.
This is the Science Show on Cambridge 105, the community radio in your city. We'll start with a hello, firstly, from me, Roger Frost.
And a hello from me, Chris Kreese, as we bring you 30 minutes of nifty science they never told us about in school. We get the inside scoop on maths, physics, chemistry and biology, especially when it happens here in Cambridge.
And let's get right on with today's guest, who works in pharmaceuticals, or more accurately, as he calls it, drug discovery. He's Sean McKenna. He works in Cambridge. His name will be familiar to many, but we'll come to reminding you why later in the chat. I started off by asking Sean about his job.
So I work for a drug discovery company in Cambridge. We work towards trying to find possible drug molecules for fighting diseases like cancer and various central nervous system disorders. Drug discovery has an incredible history, really. I mean, this goes back thousands of years, you know, before the times of Jesus, when people would be advised, if they were suffering from a fever, to chew on willow bark. Yeah. Or there would be a recreational or health reasons to use poppy sap. And obviously, there's been scientists throughout the years who have tried to isolate the active ingredients found in these natural products. So the willow bark gives rise to salicylic acid, which then gave us aspirin.
Oh,
and
right.
Something like 40,000 tons of that is made a year and get used very cheaply and very importantly for anyone who's suffering with a headache. Things like opium have given rise to morphine, and there's heroin and codeine. And this, I mean, drug discovery is an old area of interest, but it's something that as our technology and as our science and as our understanding of the world around us has grown, we've become a bit more sophisticated at trying to tackle the diseases that ail us as a species. A commonplace approach in industry for the last 20, 30 years to take a massive library full of compounds and screen them against a certain biological target and basically see whether we get many hits from that, and then you can start optimizing from there. Now, the work that I do is actually an evolved approach of that, which is called fragment-based drug discovery. Okay. So drugs are compounds of around a 500 molecular weight, which sounds like a sort of arbitrary measurement. Mm-hmm. But if you accept sort of 500 molecular weight to be about the size of a drug, most drug companies have taken compounds around a 500 molecular weight and they've tested it against their biological target, and some of them hit and some of them don't.
Okay.
And then what they'll do is they'll try and improve their hits and turn those into drugs. But the problem is that when they try and improve them, they often add extra bits on top of the drug. So you go from a 500 molecular weight drug, you might go up to a 600 or a 700.
Okay.
And while that might make the drug a better activity, more potent, it might also make it a lot more difficult to reach its biological target. Now, of course, you've got to remember that when you take a drug, you don't take, let's say, 200 mg of ibuprofen. That 200 mg of ibuprofen isn't all going to reach your brain. A load of it's going to be chopped down by your liver and excreted before it can get anywhere near a site of action.
Okay.
Some of it won't be absorbed.
Okay.
You've actually got to appreciate that there's a real number of steps for a drug to go from being a pill in your hand to actually working at the site of action. And the properties of that drug really influence whether they're actually going to do the job that you want them to do. So going back to this 600 or 700 molecular weight drug, all of a sudden, by adding all these bits, you suddenly made it that much more difficult for the drug to reach the area where it needs to work. And so it's caused a problem really in drug discovery, in that we haven't been able to find drugs that are both potent enough but also bioavailable enough, which is a sort of measurement of ability to get into your biological organism and work. What fragment-based drug discovery does is that it actually takes a step back and goes, well, if we want to add to a certain drug, our, you know, sort of hit compound, we need to start on a smaller scaffold. So rather than screen a 500 molecular weight compound or a series of 500 molecular weight compounds, you test ones that are around 200 molecular weight. And when you get hits from there, you can start adding to your 200 molecular weight scaffold. And the bits that you do add then get you up to around 500. And what you've done in that time is you've built in your potency, but you've also built in bioavailability. And it's a sort of, it's a more sophisticated way of going about drug discovery. But one of the big issues of it really is that when you're measuring very small molecules, it can be very difficult to detect them.
Given, for instance, of a target that you might be, you've tested against known targets.
When I refer to a biological target, these are, more often than not, these are proteins. Because proteins basically act as little machines, you know, little workhorses within cells and, you know, sort of within the body to perform a function. And there are thousands and thousands of proteins responsible for each different biological function. And normally, you know, these will work for you billions and billions of times over. But what happens is every so often, these proteins are made wrong. And more often than not, these can cause disease. Because all of a sudden, when a protein isn't working correctly, the whole balance of your organism goes askew. And it's what can result in things like cancer. That's a perfect example of when a cell just starts doing something ever so slightly wrong, and it can start growing far too fast, it can start replicating far too fast, it can resist the natural death of a cell. If we're able, as scientists, to track that back from, let's say, a cancer developing, we can look back and go, that has happened because this protein has started going wrong, or has started being overly produced or underly produced. And as soon as we understand the biological reason behind a disease, we can start working out a way to chemically alter that, either try and remove the problem or try and correct it. That's what we mean when we talk about a biological target. More often than not, it's a protein, and it's a protein that we're trying to fix.
Taking some drug as an example, what can you do to it to make it more interesting?
You can change an existing drug and change the actual chemical structure. And obviously that has significantly greater implications, because as soon as you've changed one part of it, it's a different drug. Yeah. For example, codeine, which is a morphine alternative, the only change to it is the addition of an extra methyl group, which is about as small an extra group as you can add to a compound. And what it does, when it gets into cells, the liver actually chops off that methyl group. So what it's done is effectively it's cut the codeine molecule, it's removed the methyl that you've introduced, and all of a sudden, it's morphine in your body now. What the implications are of codeine, and the reason that codeine is considered safer than morphine to give, and what's why you can actually get codeine over the counter, is that it only has about 10% of the efficacy of morphine. And so by making subtle changes to the chemical structure, you can actually affect how your drug works, how it works in the body, and the sort of effect and potency on its biological target.
My granny used to say that if you take an aspirin and you haven't got a headache, then that's bad for you because the aspirin doesn't know where to go.
There's definitely some truth behind taking something that you don't necessarily need. Now, aspirin's a really interesting one just on its own. The really funny thing is that the regulations that are in place these days, if someone was trying to take those drugs to market, having them never existed before, there's a good chance they would never make it.
Oh.
Because some of them are not selective enough. Some of them have sufficient side effects that a regulator could just say, no, you can't market these. I think that's really interesting, because you'll know, I mean, there are so many major pharmaceutical groups these days, and you'll hear about job losses, and about cutbacks and these really grim statistics from even some of the major pharmaceutical companies. And so many times it can be because they've got a drug so far along the way to being close to market, and then there's a certain reason that that drug has been withdrawn. Like, it might be shown to have an adverse side effect, which of course is it's really important to remember that. I mean, you only need to look back to the 1960s and thalidomide, terrible cases like that when not enough understanding has been had before a drug has gone to market, and that should be avoided. But at the same time, it's also very interesting to think that a drug that came to market over 100 years ago almost certainly wouldn't make it these days for the regulations that are in place.
Mm-hmm. I think we ought to add just briefly that we're not doctors.
No, we're not. No. This is from a slightly stood to the side point of view. Don't take any of this as professional medical advice.
No. We're really interested in drugs and how you could possibly customise it. Can you look at a chemical and say that will be effective against that?
As a society, we've developed technology to the point where we can make much more sophisticated calls on whether something is going to be effective or not. Now, there's certain techniques that I use or I benefit from in my professional life, things like X-ray crystallography, which is a fantastic technique. It's really amazing. X-ray crystallography, you take a crystal of your compound or your drug sat in the biological target that you're trying to aim towards. So let's say this is a compound sat inside a protein. You basically grow crystals of that, and you use X-rays to analyze those crystals. And it's got to a point in this technology where you're able to develop at least really high resolution images of your compound sat in this protein, mm-hmm. to the point where you can actually see which interactions it's making with the protein. And the moment you can do that, you understand intrinsically what the good parts of your drug are and what the bad parts are. And if there's a space that you can grow towards or a new area that you can grow towards, then you do that. And if you understand that there's, let's say there's one specific piece of the drug which is interacting in a really favorable way, you can retain that bit but change everything else in the drug. We have less of a scattergun approach and much more of a sort of laser-pointed, really sophisticated way of designing our drug, testing it, and being confident that it's going to do what we want it to do and leave everything else alone.
How do you see the immediate future? Do you see it as a slow future? Give us some sort of picture of whether you're going to sort out cancer before I get it.
The situation we are in at the moment reflects the wider economy and the wider society. But let's not forget that at the same time, people are still getting jobs in the industry. People are still working hard in the industry, and they're still finding sort of new and innovative and exciting ways of trying to tackle diseases. You know, I don't think that the picture is necessarily grim. The way that I've experienced the drug discovery environment, I think that there are a number of changes underway, but I think that those changes are entirely positive. And I think we're simply just being a bit more canny and a bit more savvy about the way we do things. Definitely not all rosy news, and in an ideal situation, every scientist who is out there is employed and working hard to cure the next disease. But I think that we will continue to strive in the right direction. And when the economy picks up again, you may see a bit more money floating around for new companies and for new ideas. On the topic of cancer, which is obviously something we've spoken about a bit today, we understand more about cancer than we've ever done. And we understand that it's actually a very resourceful disease and that there is no one cure. Got a number of good friends who, when I catch up with them, they ask me, have you cured cancer yet? I always try and explain that cancer is certainly not something that gets cured, but we find more and more sophisticated ways of treating it. And whether that be through new chemical entities, which of course, you know, sort of I'm and, you know, thousands of other people are working towards, or whether that be in working out new ways of combining chemotherapies, with other therapies, we're definitely in the best position we've ever been to fight cancer, and we're only getting better.
Well, we didn't mean to get round to grim near-death topics, but thank you very much, Sean.
That's an absolute pleasure.
You're listening to The Science Show on Cambridge 105.
Thank you to Sean McKenna there, talking about drug discovery in the pharmaceutical industry.
You mean as opposed to drug discovery on street corners and pubs?
I should ask, where do you spend your spare time, Roger?
Well, I was just actually reacting to this term drug discovery, you know. After our interview, Sean and I had a little chat about what gets people into science. It's one of our things here on this show. And, you know, some people say it was their teacher. Some people say it was their parents. One person told me it was a book they read.
So what did Sean say got him fired up about chemistry?
Sean mentioned that actually neither of his parents were scientists, and that his big moment of conversion was to do with anesthesia at the vet's surgery.
Oh.
Well, the idea that intrigued him was that one simple chemical, which was based on petrol gas with bits of fluorine attached to it, could knock you or the pet flat out, when a slightly different chemical had no such effect.
Ah, very interesting. Well, Sean, you did the right thing by pursuing your interest in chemistry for the good of humanity. But Roger, you stay away from those street corners and no experimenting with chemicals in the garage.
Okay, will do. And you can hear more from Sean on Cambridge 105 Saturday Sports Zone, which comes up straight after the show at 3 o'clock.
Yes, he's such a great guy. And how funny, Roger, that we've been handing over the microphones to him, I think, week on week, and we didn't even think a sports enthusiast and a chemist could be one and the same person.
Yeah, I thought he was some kind of sports writer by the day. What did you think?
I'd have put money on him being a male escort. Just teasing, Sean.
Chris, I don't know. That's very competitive, that job these days. Even I failed to get the job several times over. And you always come up against some PhD student who gets the job.
Uh-huh.
Well, we better get on to what's on.
All right. Well, today is the last day of the Cambridge Science Festival. Sad, but there will be another one next year, and it was fantastic. Tonight is the public's last chance to get to the Institute of Astronomy off Mattingly Road. If and only if, I should say, the weather is clear, there's a chance to hear a talk about astronomy and use modern and traditional telescopes on the observatory lawns. It finishes at 9 p.m. You should turn up at 7, or about 7:15. Make sure you go to the Hoyle Building, and do check the web in case the sky isn't clear. Here's hoping, looking out the window right now, that this snow blows right through and the skies do clear.
Okay, whether or not that will work out, we'll see.
Very punny, Roger.
Anyway, thanks, Chris. Cambridge now has a science centre that's open the whole year round, so it's a kind of science festival all the way through, every day of the week, pretty much. It's a place to take yourself and all the kids, and it's in Jesus Lane, and if you were just sort of placing yourself where it is, if you were next to Friends Meeting House or the ADC Theatre or the Park Street car park, you'd find it right across the road. So do drop in there, try some little experiments that they might have set up, and look, if you like, to find out more on www.cambridgesciencecentre.org, and you'll find some details there.
Thanks, Roger. And when you go, make sure you tell them that The Science Show is going to come see them for another feature on one of our shows coming up soon.
Yeah, do that. And is there anything left of the Science Festival, by the way, Chris?
Well, I'm glad you ask, because tomorrow, Sunday the 24th, there's a series of films and discussions at the Arts Picture House. The topic is the Arctic, which makes up over 40% of my homeland, Canada's landmass, and is home to some 100,000 Canadians, many of whom are Inuit and Métis. And these films are by and about the Inuit, and they give an account of the challenges of life in this very incredible but harsh environment. And the event is co-presented by the Canadian High Commission and National Film Board of Canada, the Cambridge Film Trust, and the Polar Museum. Should be great. Do check it out.
Ah, and there's one more. Finally, on Wednesday, the 3rd of April, in the evening, there's a workshop about what can be done to upgrade the millions of buildings, schools, churches, and so on to save energy. It's led by Nicola Terry from Cambridge organizations Transition Cambridge and Cambridge Carbon Footprint. Nicola will explain about the difficulties of knowing what to do to buildings, how this can be financed, and who to trust to do the work for you. She'll mention some local projects you may know about, such as Cambridge Open Eco Homes, the eCotton solar panel bulk buy scheme, and Rampton Drift. And if you come to the workshop with a project in mind, you will come away with an understanding of how to make it a success. This event is at 7 o'clock till 9 o'clock at the Stoneyard Centre, Lower Hall, St Andrew's Street. And again, the date is Wednesday, the 3rd of April.
Thanks, Roger. And for a list of upcoming talks around town, check out talks.cam.ac.uk. Up next is local science news.
You're listening to The Science Show on Cambridge 105.
We've some news that we might put under the heading of Discovered Near You. It looks at battery technology that can double the amount of energy stored at even lower cost than we're doing at present.
Ooh, should the Energizer Bunny be thrilled or nervous?
I think he'd be impressed.
You're so sure a bright pink fluffy bunny is a he, eh, Roger? I applaud your breakdown of gender stereotypes.
I don't know how I fell for that one. Well, as battery companies are well aware, our society has become very dependent on the batteries that we use in our phones, in electric vehicles, and other battery-operated devices like MP3 players and such like. Just looking around the world market for the lithium-ion battery, it's worth over $12 billion, and it's expected to reach over $54 billion in the next 7 years. That was in dollars, by the way.
Oh, wow. And I certainly would like longer battery life for my iPod. But before we jump into this really neat battery improvement, Roger, how do batteries work? Remind us.
Okay, well, in a nutshell, or a battery cell, if you like, there are three parts to a battery. The cathode is the positive electrode. That's the bit normally at the tip. The anode is the negative electrode, and that's normally the base.
Okay.
And the electrolyte, or paste, is sandwiched somewhere in between the bulk of the battery. Many of the batteries we use today combine lithium with manganese oxide or nickel oxide or cobalt oxide to form the cathode.
Right, and if my memory serves, the chemical reactions in the battery, they build up the number of electrons at the anode, right, Roger? That's the negative side. Mm-hmm. And because the electrons repel each other, they try to go to a place with fewer electrons, which is the cathode. But the electrolyte is what's keeping the electrons from going straight from the anode to the cathode.
Yeah, and eventually batteries will run down because the electrical processes change the chemicals in the anode and cathode and they stop supplying electrons. So there's a limited amount available in a battery.
Right.
Now, when you recharge a battery, you change the direction of flow of electrons using an extra power source. And the electrical process now happens in reverse. It restores the anode and cathode to the state they were in before, so you can provide the power again. But there are limits to how many times a battery can be discharged and recharged.
Right, so that makes a difference between awesome batteries and not so awesome.
Absolutely.
Batteries. And the scientists at University of Cambridge have been experimenting with how to improve battery composition. And Roger, what have they come up with?
Well, they've come up with a battery that uses sulfur.
Ooh, sulfur, that's pretty abundant, right? So that sounds like a smart choice. How do they use it?
Well, they found a way to combine the sulfur with this, I don't like this name, it's nanostructured carbon, which forms the cathode. That's the tip of the battery, if you remember.
Okay, and why is that an improvement?
Well, it's an improvement for a couple of reasons. The battery's cost is more related to the materials used as well as the actual cost of making it.
Mm-hmm.
And sulfur is an especially cheap material. The researchers say that they can substantially reduce the cost of the new battery.
Well, that is something us consumers like to hear. Cheaper is better.
And indeed, it gets better because not only will this battery be cheaper, say compared with conventional lithium-ion batteries, the carbon-sulfur electrodes achieve double the energy density for a given size.
Cheaper and more efficient, I have to say. What's not to love about that? So what's the deal with this carbon nanostructure?
Okay, well, this nanostructure, nano anything, I can't handle you. Well, the carbon-sulfur electrodes are made of nanotubes, there they go again,
very small,
high-quality carbon on top of a layer of a metal foam. The metal foam provides a large surface area for the electrode material, and this is what provides the excellent electrical conductivity. It acts as a kind of scaffold onto which the sulfur, which stores the electrons, is injected to form the cathode.
Okay, gotcha. But, okay, Roger, I've heard that lithium sulfur batteries, they have a problem. They have really short lifespans, so you can charge and discharge them 80 times, which is pretty tiny compared to the 500 charge-discharge cycles with a regular lithium-ion battery.
Yeah, this is true. But this new structure they've invented in Cambridge enhances lithium sulfur batteries to hold 80% of the charge over 250, that's more than 80, cycles of charging and discharging. And they still give more electricity per weight and are much cheaper than traditional lithium ion batteries.
Okay, very cool.
Yeah, we're putting the great minds in Cambridge to good use, and the work, we should tell, is a collaboration between Professor John Robertson of the Department of Engineering and Dr. Vasant Kumar of the Department of Material Science and Metallurgy.
Well done, guys.
And now they've formed CAM Battery. That's the name of a firm to commercialise the technology. And they've won Technology Startup of the Year 2012, Cambridge University Entrepreneurs. Well done, guys.
Yes, double well done.
And they're really running with this because the team intends to build the first machine to produce the cathode material and sell the product to a major battery manufacturer.
Oh, so can we expect to see these Cambridge-grown batteries in a shop anytime soon?
Well, the charge-discharge thing that we were talking about earlier is a bit of an issue, but these lithium-sulfur batteries are not quite good enough for consumer electronics, but the CAM battery firm is focusing their efforts now for aerospace uses and defence uses, where energy storage takes more importance over the kind of life of the battery.
Okay, fair enough. Well, what about now if we can get them to work on making more environmentally friendly batteries? Do you think that would be a possibility? I mean, I think that's where my lemon battery from science class wins out.
I think your lemon battery was brilliant, but I'm not sure you could use it to kill people like this one.
All right, well, we've got a couple of minutes left. Anything else you want to talk about, Roger?
Well, you were talking as we came in about your...
My ankle.
Your ankle?
Yes.
Chris's ankle has now got to be news.
Well, I was meditating this morning and my left ankle was whinging in pain when I was sitting on the floor. And it made me realize that every time the weather changes, you know, you get this snowstorm blowing in or a rainstorm, it seems to hurt. And I thought, gosh, why do people with broken bones or arthritis feel pain when the weather changes? What do you think, Roger?
I don't know, really. Why do that? I mean, there is a story. Is there any kind of science to it?
Well, interestingly enough, we actually need a better study by scientists on this. A lot of the evidence is anecdotal, and scientists are actually still in disagreement, but there is a barometric pressure hypothesis. And so there have been a couple studies. One, I think in 2007, researchers at Tufts University in Boston, they reported that for every 10 degree drop in temperature or a decrease in barometric pressure, that there was an incremental increase in arthritis pain, for example. Okay. So there does seem to be something to this. And I guess the idea is that as the barometric pressure drops when you get a storm front moving in, that actually releases some of the pressure on tissues, and so they can expand. And people who have an injury or arthritis, mm-hmm. they have these hypersensitized nerves. So just this little change in expansion of the tissue in the previously wounded area, it's enough to just send off pain signals through those hypersensitized nerves.
Supposing we just use you instead of some electronic equipment to help use you as a kind of barometer of the weather.
Well, I'm not sure how perfect it would be, but it does seem to be pretty strongly correlated.
Are we running out of time?
I think so. I think that's pretty much all for today.
It is pretty much the end of today's Science Show on Cambridge 105. In a few days' time, you will find a podcast recording of the show on our website, which is www.cambridge105.fm.
Yes, and you can now pick up our podcasts on iTunes. Just search for 105 Science. Our next live show on Cambridge 105 will be in 2 weeks on Saturday, 6 April at 2:30 p.m.
And if you want a reminder of that, do follow us on Twitter. It's at 105 Science. Meanwhile, if you have a science event you'd like to promote, a question about science you'd like to share, you can email us at science@cambridge105.fm.
Thanks, Roger. And that leaves us to say thank you to Sean McKenna for taking the time to talk with us. And I'll say bye from me, Chris Creese.
And I'll say bye from me, Roger Frost.
Up next on Cambridge 105, there's Sean McKenna again with the sports news.
Goodness me, he's all over the place.